Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 24th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Larry Rasmussen. Today he will be continuing his series on Jubilee and the Sustainable Society. Today's session number is 7 and is titled The Human Economy and the Economy of Nature, A Prescription for Unsustainability. Let's listen in.
The series theme this week is Jubilee and the Sustainable Society. And it goes on the premise that Jubilee is a biblical vision of an economically, environmentally, socially, and spiritually sustainable society. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about that. I'm going to come back to the Jubilee vision of a sustainable society at the end. What's going to become the focus for our attention in this period is on the reasons we live in an unsustainable society and what kinds of things need to change in order for us to get to a sustainable society. So with that, let me make a presentation. I'm going to put my watch down here and hope I remember to look at it at 6:30 when I'm going to close, if necessary, on a semicolon so that we can have some discussion for the latter part. But let me say a few words as to why we got to unsustainability. This is carrying on from a session done earlier, but I don't assume that you were there, and it's not necessary to have that background. The Ernst Troeltsch, in the social teachings of the Christian churches, said that the time of the bourgeoisie, the rise of the new economy, capitalism, modernity, our world, was a time between civilizations of constraint. Ours was the great exception to civilizations of constraint. And he said, we're living now between civilizations of constraint that went before, and he foresaw in 1911 that after the bourgeois splurge, we would again face a civilization of constraint. His good friend, Max Weber, in a famous book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, worried that capitalism would become, I'm citing Weber's image now, an iron cage that would trap us. And he said in 1904 that we have become sensualists without heart and specialists without spirit. And that technical rationality and the new economy of capitalism may well end up trapping us all. We now are seeing some of the downside of unlimited economic growth in a finite planet. And while we don't have an alternative to it, there are more and more people that are judging the present course as an unsustainable one on the terms that we live it. So that's why I want to entertain the question of how it is that we got to unsustainability, what both in our practices of our day-to-day economic life, the production, distribution, and consumption of goods, and what is it in our mindset that has made for or conformed to this world and that needs to be changed. Today I'm going to focus on economics in particular, and at the end come back to the Jubilee vision. All right, let's look at economic theory And if we have time, at the kind of technologies we have. Like Sherlock Holmes's dog that didn't bark, the clue in economic theory is in the silences. The blank spaces, the missing sounds tell the story. If you take a classic text in economics, take macroeconomics especially, the branch of economics that analyzes mass structures and dynamics and scale, and you look at the index, note what isn't there. There's not an entry for environment. There's not an entry for natural resources. There's not an entry for pollution. There's not an entry for depletion. There's no entry for sustainability either, unless it's a real recent one, and then it'll be listed as sustainable development. These spaces are blank. These dogs don't bark. These are the clues. What's the mismatch between that kind of economy, which is ours, and the economy of nature? Wendell Berry has it right. There's a huge mismatch between what he calls the big economy, which is a globalizing human capitalist economy, and what he calls the great economy, which is the economy of nature. This is the rub now. How can you have both an economics that will sustain itself in a world of 5 going on 6 billion and meet the needs of that, and at the same time have that big economy be ecologically, environmentally sustainable? There are, in many ways, reasons are cross purposes. Thomas Berry, I love these names. Why are all these people called Berry? Or Fox, Matthew Fox, or Judith Plant? I mean, why are all these eco folks named this way? Something. Well, anyway, now switching to another Berry, Thomas. Start with Thomas Berry here. Quote, "The difficulty of contemporary economics is its effort to impose an industrial economy on the organic economy of the earth. Human economics is not integrated with the ever-renewing economics of the natural world. This ever-renewing productivity of the natural world is the only sustainable economics. The human is a subsystem of the earth system. Every and all human economy is necessarily only and always a subsystem of the economy of nature. The bourgeois exception, and thus the time between civilizations of constraint, is that we found a way through the Industrial Revolution to use stored solar energy in the forms of fossil fuels to let us rearrange our whole world in a way that we did not have to conform to the renewable economy of the earth. A fossil fuel-based economy let us think that we were a species apart. And then it let us rearrange our immediate environment in such a way that we didn't have to pay attention to what nature required for its own regeneration and renewal. That, in turn, blinded us, if you will, to the fact that every human economy is always and only a subsystem of the economy of nature. So if, in our particular case, if you start putting too much carbon in the air, you affect the atmosphere, and then you start worrying about global warming as a limit on fossil fuels, or you can worry about the end of petroleum. There are lots of things, but in any case, it isn't any longer the close relationship of the human economy to the recurring cycles of nature. Differently said, just as nobody can live in a post-agricultural society, you can live maybe in a post-industrial one, you can't live in a post-agricultural one. There can be no economic order that is not totally dependent upon the planets, ecosystems, and the biosphere and the geosphere as a whole. Human economies have lots of latitude, to be sure, and new resources can often substitute for old and depleted and exhausted ones. But human economies dare not exceed tolerable environmental margins or violate the requirements for renewing and replenishing nature. Economic and production and consumption, as well as human reproduction, is unsustainable when it no longer falls within the borders of nature's regeneration. Let me put it differently. There's a real bottom line below the bottom line. If you don't recognize that the laws of economics and the laws of ecology are finally the same laws. So I didn't put up on the board here. We ought to start writing ECO-NOMICS, Eco-nomics, and then we'll start to see that the laws of economy have to conform to the laws of ecology. An expanding human economy that issues in a diminishing earth economy is a way of committing suicide by increments. And I think that's what we're doing. Okay, now, if this is true, all these things are arguable, then we need to ask what is the economy of nature that we need to pay attention to. And I've put on the board here three basic principles of nature's economies. For all of nature's awesome complexity and wonder, its economic principles are pretty simple and few. The first one is that waste equals food in nature, or food and habitat. Tossed off materials from some life forms become nourishment for other life forms or for building up habitat. Everything goes somewhere and contributes something with a minimum of energy and inputs. What is taken in is changed in a way that can be used by some other creature. Like Aldo Leopold's picture of Wisconsin, for those of you who are Wisconsinites, he has a nice picture of Wisconsin as a round river. I love this image. A round river. There's a stream of energy which flows out of the soil into plants, thence into animals, thence back into the soil, in a never-ending circuit of life and energy. This is the round river. If such a principle as waste equals food or habitat were applied to the human economy, all waste would have a place in and value to further production. And you would design the human economy so that everything that was waste at one point was food, in quotation marks. That is vital to the ongoing life of something else. Everything would be reclaimed, reused, or recycled, and would from the onset of production be made to do so. The Germans are now doing this with automobiles. The car manufacturer is responsible for the total life of that automobile, including its use of the, after it's no longer on the road. And it's interesting what it's doing to the production of automobiles. Pretty soon, you don't plan any obsolescence because you're responsible for how long those parts last. So you really work hard and not having to recycle that real soon. You got to pay the cost. All right. Paul Hawken, I didn't put his book up here, The Ecology of Commerce. He's a businessman, a very successful CEO, who's written a wonderful book called The Ecology of Commerce. And his insight is worth recording here. He says, we call ourselves consumers, but our problem is that we don't really consume. On average, for example, each person in the United States generates twice his or her weight per day in household hazardous or industrial waste, and an additional half ton of gaseous waste, such as carbon dioxide. This is not used up or consumed, but is released with the hope that the rest of nature will somehow deal with it. The rest of nature knows how to consume, we don't. We turn it over, but we don't really consume it. We don't turn it into food or habitat. The second principle of nature, nature runs off current solar income. There's only one input into Earth's economy from outside Earth. That's sunshine. Everything else is here and gets recycled. Earth is a one-time endowment. The only resource from outside is sunlight. Everything, what this means, and all of nature's economy runs in one way or another on that renewable solar income. What this means for human economics is very far-reaching, but it sort of reinforces that first principle. If sunlight's the only true addition to what is already kind of in-house, think of Earth as oikos, big public household, everything else is in-house, then reclaiming, reusing, and recycling need to qualify and characterize all production and consumption. Let me put it negatively. If a given entity cannot be reclaimed, reused, and recycled, don't make it. If it cannot be reproduced without deleterious, degrading effects, don't grow it. If the probable consequences of its use and manufacturing use cannot be reasonably known, tracked, and paid for, don't venture it, would be some implications. Okay. The third principle of, what have I got? Yeah, the third one. Nature depends on diversity, thrives on differences, and perishes in the imbalances of uniformity. Old Pharaoh could tell you about that. All the plagues that finally got the slaves out of there were nature gone awry by mass production. Whether it's locusts or frogs, nature does that. And that's when nature goes awry. Whether it's boll weevils or locusts or floods or any number of other things. Healthy systems are highly varied ones and specific to time and place. Nature is not mass produced. Diversity, variation, complexity befitting local and changing conditions and disparity to take advantage of them, that's how Earth's economy lives. That's why biodiversity is utterly crucial. It's what makes for adaptability, for evolution and survival in complex and only partially stable environments, because nature is not static, never static. It's a dynamic system. It's always changing. And biodiversity is what allows adaptability to changing conditions. Diversity breeds sustainability and stability. Our present economic scheme of globalized mass production runs in exactly the opposite way. It doesn't care what local conditions for nature's renewal sustainability are. I mean, just superficially, a mall looks like a mall wherever it is, an airport looks like an airport wherever it is, but now you grow rice in California and cotton in Arizona. These are not desert crops. And so you got to haul in the water from somewhere else, and then other claims on that water make water rights a big issue. We just haven't bothered because of what the Industrial Revolution made possible through the use of fossil fuels. We just haven't bothered to ask, what is it that is now fitting for this time and place, given the ecosystems here and the kind of biodiversity that belongs to this? So the big economy, the human economy, has preferred globalized development over sustainable community. It thereby runs against the grain of nature itself. Nor, as I said, does the big economy live off of solar income. It extracts from the one-time endowment in ways that on a crowded planet with high consumption rates in rich quarters and an exploding population threaten sustainability for present and future generations. I can say it differently. The biological life central to the economy of nature is absent in the questions of the human economy. That's why these dogs don't bark. That's why the index in macroeconomics texts, you won't find a reference to biological life there. Now there are changes being made in economics, and there's a whole new mutation of economists. It's a very welcome mutation. They're called ecological economists. And they're trying to ask what, not just what materials are we using here, but what is the cost of taking them from nature, where do they belong, and what is the cost of returning them to nature in ways that nature can further use them, to ask both about the origins of biological life and the destiny of the products and ecosystem. So that's a promising development. Okay, now what does my clock say? I got 6 minutes. All right. Why has this exception to civilizations of constraint occurred? I've given the major reason. The human economy discovered resources that let us run against the grain of nature for a period of time. But it's more than that. The human economy as a subsystem of the economy of nature, for a very long time in human history, seemed relatively small as a reality. That is, relative to the total biosystem, relative to nature's economy. It's sort of like cowboys and herds. You had enough pastures so that you could just pasture your herds here, and you didn't have to worry about taking care of those pastures because you could just move on. There were always more pastures. And that has been our assumption. Nature is not only malleable, it's not just parts. Like the chicken ad, you know, parts is parts. We've assumed that all of the nature is just sort of parts. You can hammer it together in lots of different ways. It's malleable. It's not just parts and malleable. We've also assumed that it's pretty much infinite or inexhaustible. There'll always be more pastures. There's always more trees over the next ridge of mountains. So as long as the human economy is small relative to the resources of the economy of nature, that works. We're no longer small relative to the resources of nature. We're now using up about 40% of the land net product, photosynthesis net product, that is green mass. You can't use up a whole lot because everything else is dependent upon that, including food for us. So we're no longer small relative, but we were for a very long time. Unfortunately, the economy that's still in place with the free trade agreements, NAT and NAFTA with GATT, still operates on the basis of unlimited resources and maximum freedom to exploit those. The Brundtland Commission, which was made the important preparatory document for the Rio Conference, the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in June 1992, the name of that report is Our Common Future, says that sustainable development, which is their proposal for an antidote, must include more rapid economic growth in both industrial and developing countries. A 5 to 10-fold increase in world industrial output can be anticipated by the time world population stabilizes sometime in the next century. 5 to 10 more times economic activity than we have now in order to address human needs. Well, some people in the room are shaking their head. Good reason to. But my point is that we have assumed an economy relatively small vis-a-vis the economy of nature. We're no longer that. And if we take seriously these kinds of things, we will be even less so. Another reason, and I think I've got to say a couple words about Jubilee and then stop. Another reason why we're still where we are and not somewhere else is that we don't know what in the world to do by way of an alternative to the kind of economy we have now. There are lots of experiments going on around the world. They're small, they're important. But there is no mass model for an alternative to the global capitalist economy. Millions of livelihoods depend upon the present globalized economy. And once you start pushing for major reform there, you run into human beings' livelihoods and well-being. And so there's an enormous institutional and personal resistance to altering that economy. It has to be defended. And given its institutional clout, it most certainly will be. In the United States alone, the 400 companies profiled in Everybody's Business Almanac employ or support 1/4 of the U.S. population. 400 companies are connected to 1/4 of the U.S. population. The largest 1,000 companies account for over 60% of the national product, gross national product. So while we lack the sense of progress that the industrial technological process once carried, people just don't believe in progress in the way they oftentimes used to, even though it still has that, it's still an exuberant memory for a lot of people. But the belief in it is one of kind of desperately believing in it. And when you get down to it, they really fear that their great-grandchildren are going to be living in a much depleted world. But we don't know how otherwise to retain affluence, address poverty, and secure livelihoods. And if we cannot imagine an alternative, then it doesn't exist. The dream drives the action, that's true. But if we don't have a dream about this one, it doesn't exist. Now again, I think there are lots of interesting things happening. I was going to talk about appropriated carrying capacity, and I'll only mention this about it. Carrying capacity refers to what kind of levels of life any particular region can sustain because of the requirements of the economy of nature. Appropriated carrying capacity refers to the fact that people in some areas live off the carrying capacity, not of their region, somewhere but somewhere else. All big cities don't live off the economy of nature of the metropolitan area. They live off other people's carrying capacity. Unfortunately, and this showed up at the Earth Summit, and it made people from the South and from poor nations just mad as could be, folks like George Bush came in talking about the United States as the environmental leader in the world, because we have some of the most progressive legislation and because we've done some of the most far-reaching things in environmental preservation, and made everybody else mad because the United States appropriates a whole lot of carrying capacity from elsewhere. I mean, Brazilian rainforests are cut down so that cattle ranches can grow cattle to export beef to rich countries. That's appropriating carrying capacity. Germans have a whole lot of appropriated carrying capacity. You can't depend only on the resources within the boundaries of Germany to live the life a German lives. You have to take it from somewhere else. Okay, what's this got to do with Jubilee? Got to be real quick, so we got discussion time. Jubilee assumes that the land has a life of its own, that it has its own needs and requirements for renewal and regeneration, that the economy of nature, of the land, requires sabbaticals, folks, sabbaticals. Once every 7 years, the land gets a sabbatical. And every 50th year, if anybody gets serious about this Jubilee business, it gets another sabbatical. I got two in a row there, right? 49 and 50? Yeah. Somewhere along the way, we're going to have to get into our heads that land has a life of its own. It isn't undeveloped just because the developers haven't been there yet. We think it's empty and undeveloped if there are only 5,000 species there, but we're not one of them. You know? It's a very rich life there. Okay. It has its own requirements for its own life. It needs a rest, a Sabbath, a letting be without human exploitation, Jubilee. Jubilee is also helpful because it helps us get over this, the fact that we think we're an exception now because of fossil fuels and the Industrial Revolution, that our economy isn't utterly, totally dependent on the economy of nature. The Jubilee vision is from a time, the hard pastoral life of a long pre-industrial people, when folks knew only the civilization of constraint, and how you had to deal with the constraint that was built in there. It'd be a good time for us to learn, what are we going to do with the civilization of constraint? And there are folks in the room that have lived through constraint before. There's wisdom to be gathered from that time. If the land prospered, they did. If it didn't, they didn't. They could do some things to make it a prosperous land. But if it didn't, they knew their fate was tied to it. Ours is too. We just don't know it in that way. Now it's globally true, planetarily true. But both our cognitive categories and our senses, we don't have the eyes to see, the ears to hear yet, even our denatured imagination does not let us recognize this. I mean, lots of people have lived without love, but nobody's lived without the land. Now, you may have appropriated it from somewhere else and put it at a distance from you, but nobody's lived without the land. You can, like I said, you can have a post-industrial society, you can't have a post-agricultural one. Insufficient green stuff, folks, and you lack not only food, you lack air as well. But what's intriguing about Jubilee is the apparent connection of economy and environment and their sustainability, sustained land for people and all other life, and social sustainability, debts, freed slaves, returned property. And I want to finish with an insight from the Jubilee vision, and that is that social justice and environmental justice are inextricably linked. I put just a brief scheme up here. This is four-year-old pre-kindergarten description of a society. It's a box with a few lines. All right, that indicates that societies are stratified. So I indicated rich at the top and poor at the bottom, and the power is unevenly divided between rich and poor, or sometimes there's a majority and minority, sometimes, you know, poor majorities. Over here, I put a line which says the benefits from society, and the widest benefits come from those that are higher up in the stratification. The fewer benefits are for those that are down. So they get an inch of benefits, and these folks get 8 inches of benefits, and the people in the middle get 4 inches of benefits. The burdens of society are disproportionately fall upon the less powerful, generally the poor in society, and the rich are buffered from most of the burden. Now, it's not true that native peoples of these of this hemisphere never degraded their environments. They did, and sometimes it may have been a reason for their own collapse. What is true is that those communities degraded their environments when they became stratified societies, and the rich and more powerful, their lives were buffered from the environmental degradation. So it was still in their interest to keep folks who were suffering environmental degradation doing what they were doing for the rich until the point came when it was so environmentally degraded that there were social consequences for everybody. This is now what is happening on a global scale. The rich of the world are buffered from feeling the negative consequences of degraded environments. We still retain the benefits therefrom. So that's a problem that comes with the stratification of societies. So you have to go outside of Washington State and outside of the United States. And you got to go to Papua New Guinea, or you've got to go to the Philippines, or you can go to degraded land in this country, the homes of indigenous peoples most anywhere. If you know about environmental racism, you know that there is a disproportionate number of toxic waste dumps in African American and Native American communities. These things shake out by race and class. My point is that social injustice and environmental degradation have a certain kind of correlation. And one of the beauties of the biblical vision of Jubilee is that it ties together economic, environmental, social, and spiritual sustainability. There's something going on there between giving the land a rest for a year, releasing the slaves, forgiving everybody's debts as you forgive your debtors, etc. Okay, I have exceeded the time. So, comments, questions? In the back.
Can you tell us two things? One, where do you get your information on the proportion of land that is impacted from blacks and minorities? And with regard to degrading that. Is that a surveyed inventory or something?
Yes.
And then who does that? And then the other one, you mentioned a 40% photosynthetic
balance. Yeah, NTT.
Is that the balance that we're at now, or the balance where you can't go below it?
No. That, I'll start with the latter one first. that 40% is the balance now from land ecosystems, not counting marine ecosystems, but life on land. It's estimated that the human beings use 40% of the total photosynthesis product. That has been gradually going up, and I can get you the sources on that. Marine ecosystems, it's not that much, but it has also been going up, and we've been drawing more and more on marine ecosystems. In fact, a significant number of the world's great fish stocks are now seriously depleted, so that the United States, for example, has had to pay fisheries not to fish, New England fisheries, not to fish the Grand Banks. Now, back to your first question about the correlation of toxic wastes and populations that sort out on the basis of race and class. This was a real contribution of the churches. The United Church of Christ's study on toxic wastes and race was the breakthrough here, and putting it in the public eye. It was done in a very simple way. You know, church folks got no big budgets. You can't hire all sorts of people to do prime research. What they did was take U.S. government data about the location of toxic wastes, and then they took U.S. Census materials about who lived there. And they just ran this through the computers to see where those waste sites were located vis-a-vis the populations living there. And they found out that race was the highest correlation with toxic waste, and class was a second, and race class together would make a potent kind of combination. Well, the United Church of Christ, having then published that 1987, I think. The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, thought that was worthy of confirming or rebutting. You know, check it out. And so the EPA took it on in a more sophisticated way than little church organization could, and ended up confirming it. Now, it must have been 83 or 84. I say that because now, a 10-year after follow-up report study has been done. And there are some changes, and they are negative. There's an even higher correlation. So it hasn't changed for the good. Let's see. And again, if you want documentation, I can provide the published sources for you. The National Journal of Law did something on the same order with respect to urban communities in particular, and again found that the siting of toxic, and generally speaking, environmental degradation was heaviest in poor communities and communities of minorities than in other communities. The other side of the tracks has always been more toxic.
Addition to that, there's a study came out of Washington just recently, Washington State, indicating that they were looking for intent.
And
the intent was not to do that. You see, so they came up with this statement that, you see, when they were initially located there, they weren't necessarily always in the minority areas. What they didn't say was that they then rapidly, if they weren't cited in minority areas, they became rapidly minority because all the rich people moved out. Mm-hmm. And then they became minority areas. And they said, well, the intent is more important.
Yeah.
So we always go with we're not at fault. We really didn't mean to do that.
Yeah.
And then it happened that way. So really, we're okay people because we didn't cite them there. So that's the wiggle room that people are trying to get out of.
The intent business is one thing. However, the same studies found out that enforcement of regulations also shook out differently.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in white areas and affluent areas, the enforcement and the collecting fines, etc., was at a higher level than in poor areas. Now, again, I'm not really terribly much interested in intent. I'm more interested in what does it say about power and the way it works out. I don't think that white folks said, let the black folks do that. What they did is that because they had more power to influence themselves in an organized way, the reinforcement happened there and not somewhere else. So it again still reflects social stratification and locations of social power. It isn't. I really wouldn't look at these things in highly sort of personalized form. There's some of that there, but that's not the important thing. Yeah.
Mark. First, I wanted to say amen to your presentation.
Thank you.
I
don't know if that's yes or it's over.
No. Let me so.
Okay, may it be so. All right, we'll let it go at that.
The word I would like you to use, though, instead of nature, I think, is creation.
Okay.
I'll tell you why. About a century ago, we had a lot of economists and sociologists who based their disciplines on a certain view of nature called Darwinian view of nature.
Yeah.
And they developed something called social Darwinism.
Yes.
And they picked out a different set of pieces, competition, nature's tendency to produce many more of a given species,
how
to compete against scarce resources, etc.
Yeah.
And I think your view and ours is through and through a kind of grasp of nature via a certain interpretive frame.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it's creation.
Yeah.
So I guess I worry that if too many people of the wrong sort catch on to the nature business, all they need is a slightly different view of nature, and we have a kind of different bio or economics, depending on which vision of nature is informing.
Yeah, that's helpful. I forgot to plug a book called Earth Community, Earth Ethics, which will be coming out in October.
Change the title to Creation.
No, we're still all right on this one. And it tells you a little bit about what's in it on top and then how to get it on the bottom. All right? If you want to take that out of the village so the village doesn't have another piece of paper to recycle, that would be kind of you. In the manuscript, I have a chapter on the integrity of creation. And creation is a theological word and not a scientific one. It's all things together, in with and before God. And in fact, I kind of skipped over the lines when I was sharing with some of you this evening, the references to the integrity of creation, because we haven't done what I think is a necessary piece to talk about how creation works. But I think yours is an important point. The other thing that is treated at more length in the book, which I haven't done here in this presentation or in the others, is I actually say we shouldn't use the word nature as not in deference to creation, although there are good reasons for going that route too, but because the way in which we've talked about it here has perpetuated the problem. It has located us over against or outside nature. And the book says nature is a comprehensive term. We are an expression of it. It is the rest of us. And I try to talk about it that way, and then try to talk about the human economy as one sector of the larger economy of nature, and how does it work. I find that if I just sort of do that straight away, maybe we should, but that the conversation always slips back into, or people always think nature as non-human,
yeah,
non-human nature instead of the overarching one. But one of the many splits that we'd better get over is a split between nature and culture, history and culture. Culture is a human rendition of nature. All culture is utterly, totally dependent upon nature and is an expression of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, our ideas themselves are as much a part of nature as is the flowering of the rainforest. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brian.
I was wondering if you could maybe trace a little bit or speak to some of the conditions for this perspective of nature that are kind of grow out of the Christian sort of Genesis, subdue uh-huh. the land, and
yeah.
the whole sense of God yeah. giving us the earth to
yeah.
do with
yeah.
as we will. Is that,
yeah.
I mean, it's one interpretation of
yeah.
Genesis.
I want to say two things real quickly. One is I want to add one more thing, which isn't unrelated to yours, to Marx. The other thing, Mark, is that as human beings who do act out of our perceptions, out of our consciousness, we don't live in sort of raw nature. We live inside our notions of nature and act upon them. That's why if we have a reading of nature which is social Darwinist, we will have an economy where that will be affirmed by that reading of nature, and in fact has been. Social Darwinism has been an earth faith,
yep.
and still is. So one has to ask, what understanding of nature is it that you're working with if you're asking for a human economy to conform to the way nature works? Because we have to always be conscious that it's our filters there. Now, what's helpful, I find, in talking about those crucial Genesis passages, especially Genesis 1:28, on subdue the earth, have dominion over it. There are a number of things, and that's a series in itself. One is to realize that those accounts themselves come into being in the Iron Age. When do these scriptures, what life do they reflect? Well, this is a very important event in human history. It's the first human revolution, the agricultural revolution. And it's a time of settled human communities. And it's a time when, in fact, you are having some kind of dominion, if you will. Because 99.5% of human history is lived out in hunter-gatherer societies. The Christian and Hebrew scriptures do not reflect any of the experience of human beings for 99.5% of our story. And that's a 99.5% where people lived and their own rhythms had to conform almost precisely with the rhythms of nature around them. But these scriptures reflect the change and fact of settled societies and having some dominion. That's just important to know that. But then there are still all sorts of qualifications. It's not only human beings that are given dominion. The sun is to rule by day, the moon is to rule by night. The blessing to be fruitful and multiply is given to birds and fishes as well as human beings. I mean, you got to sort of read this with a close eye. What I find most helpful, though, is to read Jewish exegesis through the years. Be fruitful, be subduing the earth and have dominion has never meant in the whole history of Jewish exegesis. Do what you wish with the earth in accord with human design. In fact, Jewish Sabbath is precisely a continuing warning against human intervention. One of the things on Sabbath you do not do is intervene in any way in history, and the Sabbath laws are back of the Jubilee law. And the other thing is, if you look at the history of exegesis of Genesis 1:28, what you will find is that it's after the Industrial Revolution that it takes on this kind of unqualified capacity of human beings to do with as they wish. That's reading, and we got to be conscious of what the eyes that we're reading this with. So you got to watch the relationship of dominion and tilling and tending in Genesis 2, how they play together. And the word for to cultivate in Genesis is the word to serve. And speaking of Jubilee, in English, cultivate is cultus, worship, and cultivate, the soil, and culture. Those three somehow have to get together. And Jewish exegesis does preserve that. Time to go, folks. Thanks a lot.